That one is super.
This meeting of the Senate Environment and Energy Committee will come to order. And because this is our first meeting of the year, wanted to make sure all committee members, everyone are familiar with staff and so on. And I know Senator Osmick is going to be taking over as Republican lead. And we have from Senate Counsel and Research, John Fuller is dropping us because he has too many other committees. So we will have Carlin and Greg will be back again. Both of them will be staffing the committee regularly. And Dan Mueller, who's not here because he apparently slipped on the ice. We'll be here from Senate Fiscal stuff, so watch out on the ice. And maybe the folks at the table there, Peter and everyone, can introduce yourselves.
I'm Gloria Gunville, Senate Majority Research.
Peter Lavis, Senate GOP.
Julie Byrol, Senator
Kambach. And with that, Hannah and Barb are still staffing committee, and we have a lot of things that will be coming up. Not that many bills introduced yet, but that happens soon. Today we're just going to have two things, both related to energy. The first of which was Department of Commerce put together at the legislature's request a year and a half ago a study on Minnesota Renewable Energy Integration and Transmission Study. And if we can have Bill and the four or five of you come up to the table and make your presentation whatever order you wish.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Bill Grant for the Department of Commerce. And it's our pleasure to present to you a high-level overview of a very detailed technical study that was performed by Minnesota utilities and transmission owners under the oversight of the Department of Commerce. And in a moment, I'll introduce Matt Scherger, who was our technical consultant, who really was deserves the lion's share of the credit for making sure that the study was completed on time and according to the statutory issues that we were asked to take a look at. Rather than trying to show the overview on the screen, which I think only three of you can probably see from here, I think you all have the handout that's labeled Minnesota Renewable Energy Integration and Transmission Study. So we'll be speaking from that. And I will start with the second slide, which is the overview. And as many of you recall, in 2013, the Minnesota legislature adopted a requirement for this study, which goes by the acronym MRITS, the Minnesota Renewable Energy Integration and Transmission Study. As I mentioned, it was conducted by Minnesota utilities and transmission companies in coordination with the Midwest Independent System Operator, or MISO, and it was a very detailed technical engineering study. Department of Commerce's role was to oversee the study and to appoint the Technical Review Committee, and we'll be identifying for you who was involved in that committee. This was a study designed to look at increasing our renewable energy standard to 40% by 2030. Recall that it's now at 25% by 2025. And then also to look at higher proportions thereafter while maintaining system reliability. The study, and Matt and others will be pointing this out, really incorporates and builds on earlier work that was also directed by this body, most notably the wind integration study, which was completed in 2006 prior to passage of the first renewable energy standard a year later. Flipping to the second or the next slide, just to give you a sense of the schedule for this project, we got started in the June to August timeframe of 2013. That's when we were looking at the studies that had come before, both here in Minnesota and elsewhere, and working with stakeholders to identify really the scope for the study, and we did at that point develop a draft technical study scope and accepted recommendations for members to sit on the technical review committee. September, we held a stakeholder meeting to discuss the objectives, the scope, the schedule, the process for the study, which, as you might recall, was on a very tight timeline. When we first talked about performing a study like this, the people that I rely on for advice about such things told me that it really ought to be a two-year study, not a one-year study. Well, we did it in 1 year in any event, and I think without cutting any corners that would lead to anything less than a completely robust study. In September, October, we finalized the study scope, and in October appointed the technical review team. A year later, or roughly a year later, the technical team completed its study, and this was guided by the technical review committee, which was apprised of the study as it was going along and were clearly supportive of the study findings. At this point, I'm going to turn the mic over to, unless there are questions on what I've said so far, to Matt Scherger to describe the rest of the study and its findings.
Hey, thank you, Bill. I'm Matt Scherger. I'm a consultant to the Minnesota Department of Commerce, and I'll step through the slides in a high level and give you a flavor of the study, and then we hope there'll be questions and discussions. So if you look at slide 4, picking up where Bill left off, the study, I want to emphasize that this integration study is really focused on reliability impacts of increased variable renewables, wind and solar energy on the regional grid, and the associated costs of those reliability impacts. The scope for the study really came from the statutory guidance, from stakeholder input, and then from refinements from the technical study team. And as you see on slide 4, there's really three studies within this single study. There's what's called a power flow analysis, which is a transmission study, how much wire is needed regionally to deliver these increased levels of variable renewables, wind and solar energy. Second, there's what's called a production simulation analysis. So once we look at studying how much transmission or wire would be needed for increased levels, we want to look at the operation of the regional grid throughout the year. So Bill mentioned the levels that were studied, 40 and 50% renewables. Those are annual averages. In this second part of the study scope, the production simulation analysis, we want to look at each hour through the year to see if on average, we have 40 or 50% level of renewables, what's happening in those hours where we have much higher, where the load and the consumption is lower and the wind's blowing hard or the sun's shining brightly, and how is the grid operating in those challenging hours? Can the regional grid handle that in those hours? And then the third piece of it is what's called a dynamics analysis, which after making sure that there's enough wire, enough transmission for these increased levels of renewables, and making sure that the system can operate in balance and can handle the variability in each of the hours, we want to make sure it can operate stably, which is really means that if there's some disturbance on the system, will it come back to a stable operation? We want to make sure that there isn't some situation in the regional power system from these increased levels that could cause a destabilization in the regional power grid. So it was a very challenging study. It was tough technically, and it was tough schedule-wise. If you look to the next slide, the study team, I'd like to introduce on the far end here, Gordon Peach from Great River Energy, who's the Director of Transmission Planning and Operations at GRE. And Gordon really worked hard to engage and coordinate the work of all the Minnesota utilities and transmission companies on the study to make sure that all of our utilities and transmission companies were fully engaged and participating. And then immediately next to me is Jared Alhalina, who's a regional transmission planning strategist with Great River Energy. And he was the technical study team lead throughout the study and worked with the full technical team that worked on this. So that involved engineers, again, from all our utilities and transmission companies, from our regional grid operator. We also had a couple of excellent consulting firms, Excel Engineering Incorporated, which is a power flow analysis company here in Minnesota, did the power flow study, and then GE Energy Consulting helped with the dynamics and operations study work. So I want to emphasize that this was really a deeply collaborative study. There were a lot of folks engaged. We really had the best talent from our regional utilities and grid operators, and it's through the work of Jared and Gordon that really coordinated and directed and guided that work through the year. We also had, by statute, an independent technical review committee, which had not only regional experts but national experts from our national labs in renewable energy, experts in power system operations and transmission planning, that did independent review of the technical study team's work throughout the year, reviewing methods and assumptions and models, as well as results and key findings. And it's really important, again, it's a deeply collaborative study, and this full group of folks reached consensus on how to do this study and what the results were and what the findings were. Slide 7 just outlines the scenarios. We touched on those already, but really for the detailed technical work, there are three main scenarios. We started looking at the current renewable energy standard and solar energy standard in Minnesota being fully implemented, as well as the renewable energy standards in neighboring states being fully implemented. And then we built up from there, moving Minnesota to 40% in scenario 2, and then built from scenario 2, moving Minnesota to 50% in scenario 2. And also in the second scenario, moving the region up 10% above where it would be otherwise if our neighbors' RESs were fully implemented. So we wanted to look at how do the impacts work if others increase their level of renewables as well. Just stepping forward here, to do the study, we had to cite these future levels of wind and solar for the Minnesota higher levels of renewables. Wind energy was cited in Minnesota and the Dakotas and Northern Iowa. Increased levels of solar were cited in Minnesota. And then to increase the whole region, that was cited per regional planning practices across the region. I want to touch just briefly on the power flow analysis, the transmission planning work. This was really work that Jared Alhalina was deeply involved in as leader. So let me touch on the key findings, and if there's questions, we'll have Jared jump in on those. I'm on slide 9 now. Thank you. And so for power flow analysis, conceptual transmission planning, in scenario 1, we found that the existing transmission is robust. There would need to be some upgrades to the existing wire, approximately $375 million in upgrades to existing transmission would be needed to increase renewable levels to 40% in Minnesota. It is a conceptual transmission plan, a conceptual analysis, hasn't been optimized, but found that the existing transmission with that level of upgrades could work at 40% level. On slide 10, scenario 2, moving Minnesota to 50% and moving the region, our neighbors, 10% above where they would be otherwise in their current standards, pretty significant transmission impacts. There would be several major new transmission lines needed, as well as mitigations to existing lines, something on the order of about $2.5 billion worth of transmission in that second scenario case. And there would certainly need to be more transmission planning work done, not only in Minnesota, but in the region to go to that level. Again, not just 50% for Minnesota, but increasing the upper Midwest by a chunk as well. Slides 11 and 12 just briefly outline the operational analysis that was done and then the dynamic stability analysis that was done. And both of these, as well as the transmission planning, were really detailed, deep-dive looks at the grid and how it works and how it operates. In the operational analysis, as I mentioned earlier, we did study work where we really dispatched generators to meet load and looked at in detail how wind and solar were generating in every hour of the year, trying to find those areas where the system might be stressed, where there might be challenges with ramping of existing generators, or there might be challenges with meeting load. We also used that analysis to find the most challenging, the scariest hours of the year, again, where there would be, in those hours, much higher renewables or a lower load, to take those into the dynamic stability analysis. And in that dynamic analysis, which I described briefly earlier, again, we're looking at trying to stress and disturb the system, making sure that it can maintain stable operation. So slides 13 and 14 just summarize the key findings of the study, and let me step through those, and then we can take questions and discussion if you like. So the general conclusion on slide 13 for 40% scenario one, renewable energy in Minnesota, is that the system can be successfully operated for all hours of the year, that the system worked operationally with those levels. It does assume that level of upgrades to existing transmission lines that I mentioned earlier, but the system can work operationally. The dynamic stability analysis found no fundamental stability problems at the 40% level in that scenario one. Slide 14 outlines the key findings and conclusions for the 50% level, again, in that case, raising the upper Midwest 10% above their full RESs, as well as moving Minnesota to 50%. Operationally, the system worked well with the significant transmission upgrades that were identified. So, as I mentioned earlier, in this scenario, two at 50% and 10% higher for the Midwest, there was a significant chunk of transmission needed, but with that, the system could operate. And there was not a dynamic stability analysis done in this case, and that would be important to do that before moving forward with those kinds of levels. It was simply a study schedule issue to get to that additional work in scenario two in the 50% level. So with that, I will conclude, and again, the team would welcome questions and discussion. Thank you.
Sure. Before we have questions, do either Mr. Alvalina or Mr. Peach have any comments you want to make as part of it, or just in response to questions?
We'll just respond to questions.
Okay, thank you. Senator Weber and then Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sugar, I have a couple of questions here as relates to different parts of the report or your summary here. When we talk about cost of transmission, I assume we're talking only about the transmission system itself. Is that correct? And what I'm getting at is there aren't any costs of additional generation or interconnection cost in order to get the power to the transmission system. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's correct.
Okay. So all of those costs would be in addition to what you're outlining within this report.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that is correct. Again, this was report was analysis was focused on the reliability impacts.
Okay.
And the cost of those reliability impacts.
Mr. Chairman, as you talked about, assuming a 10% or the upping by 10% for renewables by surrounding states. If they don't go that route, does that have any impact on the system?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, it does. I mean, that adds significant stress to the system to do that.
And then also, has there been any thought in this, as we talk about reliability and what have you, as we, I don't know if it's a reliability issue or not, I guess, but as we talk about go into my areas, for example, where we have had a demand that has actually not kept up with the production capabilities of our electricity providers at this point. If they're involved in these additional mandates, if we go that route, does that pose any problem with the existing systems that are still in play? And as these systems are maybe mothballed in time due to other plans, has there been any analysis of that interconnection of what happens in there? Because actually, as we go through or forward in time, isn't there going to be, as some of these plants become outdated and they probably don't get permitted to be put back in place, then there's going to be some of this by natural sources that the companies go to renewables in order to fill that gap. Has there been any talk about those type of analyses?
Mr. Chair, Senator, if I understand correctly, there's been some. This study, which was just recently completed, began a year and a half ago. And again, it was a deeply analytical study, so we had to set models based on what was known at that time. So this study and analysis took into account announced retirements of plants and plans of utilities at that time. But a lot has changed already over a year and a half. It's the feeling of the technical study team that the results are indicative of what was known at the time. But sure, there'll be additional changes going forward, and those details matter. It's one of the reasons that the transmission planning is described as conceptual. It's not a plan that you would directly build transmission off of. You would need to study the details, partly to account for these kinds of changes that you're talking about.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned that there's been a number of changes already, and what might I ask what the nature of those changes are, since the study was instituted?
There have been additional approvals of plants and lines. Many of those changes were accounted for in the study because they were planned at the time we started. Okay. But as we continue to move forward, there will be some additional ones. I guess I'm not aware of significant ones.
Okay.
Senator Hoffman, then I have Senator Rose and Senator Brown listed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What a great discussion. I spent the summer like drinking water from a fire hose on energy and policy, and it's amazing. You guys forget more in a day than I think I'll ever know. But one of the things that intrigued me was, as we look at regulations and we look at where we want to get to, whether it be the EPA saying 40%, whether we're Oregon saying 48%, Minnesota now wanting to look at a renewable standard. The holy grail that I found out, and I'm wanting to know if that's included in your projections, is there was Minnesota Power was striking a future discussion, and they're already doing it. They're in the mix of doing it. And they're getting the wind from North Dakota and the hydro from Alberta or Manitoba. Alberta is where they're getting their hydro. And when you looked at that, did you project out that far that when that systems are up and running and fully functional, is that projected into your 40% and 50%?
Mr. Chair, Senator, both of those items were accounted for in the modeling. Again,
okay.
The utilities were deeply engaged in developing the models and studies, and so the wind that was being developed by Minnesota Power in North Dakota, as well as the anticipated additional hydropower from Canada, were both accounted for.
Okay.
in the study.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a follow-up to that, you know, in Illinois, we know that there's going to be a number of coal plants that are going to take off the grid, and they're looking to, you know, have discussions. And they're a split state, MISO, and they're also, what's the northern part?
PJM.
Another acronym. And, you know, I would almost see this as an opportunity for us to get ahead of the curve and start to, you know, utilize our resources and perhaps sell to other states. And I don't know if that's something that would be considered in your conversation, Commissioner Grant, or...
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hoffman, certainly as we look to higher levels of penetration of renewables, and Minnesota is a place with some unique advantages in terms of the cost of renewables here, especially wind versus other places to our south and east. Yes, export to those other markets is certainly a strong possibility.
Thank you. No more.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sugar, I was wondering on slide 14, it says in the first little bullet point, assume significant upgrades and expansions to the transmission system, the $393 million. Does that include the distribution upgrade? And I'm not sure if Senator Weber asked that question or not. I think I was reading.
Here, Senator Rosen, I'm sorry, the distribution?
Distribution upgrades. Right, connections with the wind or the solar onto the line. Does that include that?
It does not include.
It does not include that.
The local interconnections. It includes what's called the bulk electric system, which is the high voltage portion.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, if I could.
Chair Rosen.
Did the findings ever include, or did it ever come into account two things: the federal production tax credit, if that is going to be ongoing, and what that would do to the industries, whether it's wind or solar expansion, because that's a key component to these folks developing.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, no, and again, the reason is that this really wasn't a cost analysis for what expanding to a 40 or 50% renewable energy standard would look like in total. It was really looking just at the impacts to the bulk electric system and whether with modifications that system could remain stable with those higher amounts of variable generation.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Grant, then did you also include the natural gas expansion and the component for the backup system of natural gas to the wind industry? Because there will have to be an obvious a backup system in place.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, the study included all the resources that were necessary and that would be prudently planned under these scenarios. So it's really a very detailed look at what generators would be needed given all this wind and solar to keep the system reliable, to maintain resource adequacy. And some of that's some natural gas generators. So part of the model building here, the detailed work by our regional utilities grid operator working together on this, was to look at what generators would be needed. But part of it is looking at how can existing generators flex? How can they ramp up and down as well? So it's partly additional natural gas generation, but it's partly looking in detail at how the other generators that are on the system work at these levels.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Hoffman mentioned the hydro, and I know Senator Hoffman knows this, but hydro isn't a part of this 40% renewable, but we do have a bill to correct that this year if you'd like to sign on to it, Senator
Absolutely.
Hoffman.
Absolutely.
So, good. Thank you. Mr. Sugar, on slide 10, for this scenario two, we're looking at over $2.5 billion for expanding transmission lines and upgrades. I'm wondering how many miles of transmission line this amounts to.
Maybe if we can defer it just for a bit.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I don't know that offhand, but we'll grab that number.
Okay.
Quickly.
Thank you. I'd be interested in hearing. And then, Mr. Chair, Mr. Grant, you had pointed out that this isn't a cost analysis, but I'm wondering when we would see a cost analysis and if you have any estimates on what that's going to look like.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Brown, we are, as part of an interagency work group, performing cost analysis on a range of options, including an expanded renewable energy standard. I expect that work to be completed within the next month or so. So we'd be happy to return and report that to you when we have it.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Grant, I look forward to that. Thank you.
I'm not sure who to answer this, but in terms of the, we're talking 15-year period of time, and I know that I've heard from some of the utilities about transmission upgrades and stuff needed right now. How much of a change, I mean, if supposing there's no change in the RES, how much transmission work is going to be done in between now and 2030 related to things like this? I mean, how much of this is changing every day anyway? Is it, well, if we pass a standard, we're going to have to do this, and if we don't pass a standard, we're not doing this? How does this fit into the big picture of what happens in terms of what GRE and other utilities and what we're going to need for the grid, what's happening anyway?
Mr. Chairman, so there is ongoing expansion to the grid happening already. We have plans that have been developed over recent years for the current RES levels. We've seen some of that, the what's called the CapEx Group 1 lines that have been developed and going in places, going into place, as well as the lines that came out of the MISO, the regional grid operator, planning to meet regional renewable energy standards, what's called the MVP, the multi-value project lines. And those kinds of developments will be implemented in Minnesota and neighboring states over the coming 15 years. That work that's already planned was incorporated in here, and so these amounts that we're talking about here are above that.
I understand that, but I'm asking how much are those? I'm just trying to get ballpark. These are huge numbers, and what is the thing? I mean, Senator Rosen had a bill last year that we for transmission for shipping power out of state. What happened? I mean, when you talk about the total investment in the grid in Minnesota in the next 15 years, what level are we talking about? When you account not just what this study was about, but we're talking about for shipping power elsewhere, we're talking about for the regular grid. I'm just trying to get an overall sense of what kind of numbers we have.
So are we talking like MVPs? And
yeah. Do you have the Quebec number?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, if we look, basically look at it.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I would say that we're talking about $4.5 billion is what we're looking at between now and the next 15 years. Some of that has been planned, some of that is presently underway, and that's approximately what will be occurring in the future.
And Mr. Ahulina, is that who pays for this? Is that through the utilities? Is how much is, I mean, how is it allocated? Who's covering the long distance transmission things versus other ones? Does MISO determine how much everybody pays, or who allocates that cost?
Yeah, it's a combination. Some of the very, very large projects are allocated per the MISO tariff, and then others are shared locally here depending on where the benefits are received.
Senator Rosen, did you have a...
Yes, I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also just wanted to zero down on a figure, if it's coming in about the additional cost, if it's going to be for the capital cost for these upgrades, how much that's going to be for the upgrades for the distribution, and also basically the payment for the net metering power, how much that would be too if we're going to do the net metered power. So I just want to ask you, Commissioner, your figures ongoing will include those
Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, well, certainly when we're looking at a renewable energy standard and asking utilities to comply with such a standard, we include everything that would be allowed to count toward that standard. Typically, we don't include the very small distributed gen in those numbers, the stuff that would be net metered. We're looking primarily at the larger projects that utilities enter into contracts for in order to meet the much larger requirements of a renewable energy standard. So any cost estimates you see from us on a renewable energy standard will certainly include the transmission costs that were identified here, and then the actual costs of that new equipment, that hardware, and its connection to the grid. Probably won't include the distributed gen because that's typically not included when we estimate these costs.
The upgrades.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I used a lifeline on the transmission miles question. It's about 1,500 miles in that scenario, too. So very significant transmission expansion.
Thank you.
Mr. Sugar, in response to a question from Senator Weber before, I wanted to make sure I heard what you said correctly. If other states up their renewable energy, is that, I think the question was, if they don't do that, does that make it more stable or less stable? Which way is it more difficult, if they up their standards or they keep them down? What I heard from you, I wasn't expecting. But
Mr. Chair, generally, when we're looking at reliability of the regional grid, I think generally, if other states are increasing higher, that would tend to stress the overall system more, which is what we wanted to look at here. The study results really show, in both scenarios, a remarkable amount of flexibility in the regional grid. But of course, as folks know, the transmission is important. It's important to make sure the grid's stiff enough to tie the system together.
And in terms of the regional grid, if we're at 25 by 25 or supposing 40 by 30, what, since our 40 is Minnesota stuff, how much are we exporting any energy at that point? I mean, I know net we're buying and selling all the time, but since Minnesota had virtually none of its own other than the power plants we put in, are we exporting any Minnesota energy, not on hour by hour, but at some point do we get to what portion of the renewable energy on the MISO grid are we?
Mr. Chair, so currently we import and export, as you described, depending on the hour. It flows back and forth. Currently, and under the anticipated levels, under the current RES, we're still annually a net importer. So the study results show that this scenario one, going to 40% level, on an annual basis, kind of brings that more towards a balance, and going to the 50% level on an annual level tends to make us more of an exporter. But again, under all of these cases, whether we look at where we are now or our current RESs, we're flowing back and forth all the time.
And I had one final one, and that is, compared to the 2006 was the wind integration study, was there, I mean, the concept was the same. Was the scope of this one bigger or smaller, or basically just this is an 8-year later upgrade to that, or 9-year later upgrade to that, or is there significant differences in what you did then and compared to now?
Yes, Mr. Chair, this is a significantly more difficult and broader scope than the 2006 study. So I described earlier in the on slide 5 the three pieces that were part of this study scope. And the 2006 integration study really only looked at one of those pieces. The 2006 study really only looked at the operational analysis. This one looked at the transmission, the power flow, the operational, and the stability. And it's really because we'd learned so much in these prior studies and that we wanted to go deeper and look at much more challenging conditions in these studies. And it was through our scoping process and working not only with stakeholders, but working with our utilities to say, what concerns do you have? What areas do you see possible challenges that we develop this broader, much broader scope compared to the 2006 study?
Thank you. Are there any other questions from members of the committee? Mayor Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure who can answer this. So basically, because much of this transmission goes through Senator Weber in my district, our Senate district, and there are some significant issues with some of this expansion down there. Scenario one says that we can increase to 40% without just some 54 facilities upgrades to existing transmission lines. So we're not talking about, we're just talking upgrades, not a whole new transmission line. And so I'm just kind of confused. Are we using what we already have and we're just upgrading that for $373 million, $393 million?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, yes, that's correct. I mean, it's an important amount, but it is upgrades to existing lines. It is not new transmission lines in the 40% case.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, on the 50%, we would be expanding those transmission lines along with the upgrades for $2.567 million, $2 billion.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, that's correct. Some of those new lines are second circuits on lines that are being built currently, so second wires on the same towers, but some are new transmission lines where there aren't currently transmission lines under the 50% case.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chair, the $393 million does not include distribution upgrades.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, so this was not a study of the distribution system. All of the renewable resources were interconnected to the high voltage system. It doesn't include those higher voltage interconnections as we discussed earlier.
And one of the points you were saying before when somebody asked about net metering, you said you're not factoring that in some days because the amounts are so small, or because that would tend to be does it tend to be the opposite because it's more generated locally, or is it, it's not that simple to describe it that way?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the net metered facilities almost exclusively are interconnected at the distribution level rather than high voltage levels. So that's the bright line.
Okay. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And also when you talk about upgrades, transmission upgrades, is there any point at which you're actually increasing the voltage of the line itself? Taking it from a 345 up higher than that, or whatever the case might be?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Weber, we did not look at increasing the voltage. That was something in our toolbox, but we didn't take it out.
Okay. Senator Hosmick and then Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Referring to slides 9 and 10, I want to just confirm something I just heard. In response to Senator Rosen. So the 373 being estimated here, that is just for the main lines. That is not any additional cost going downstream into houses, for lack of a better term. This is just high voltage, or am I misinterpreting that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it includes all the items on the bulk electric. We wouldn't anticipate there would be any things that are excluded at the consumer end or at the house end. What isn't included is the local connection, the new wind plant or the new solar plant to get up onto the high-voltage electric system to put their power up on the system.
Mr. Chair, to follow up on that then, is there an estimate on how much the additional cost that would be? As a ballpark number, or maybe that's something to bring forward to us and upcoming presentations.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we could try to estimate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Because obviously we want to make sure we get the whole package of how much this is going to cost, not just carve out certain sections that we suddenly are surprised by years from now. One final question, Mr. Chair. I didn't see in here, and I apologize for not being in the room at the time at the beginning of your presentation. Over what period of time do we anticipate between slides 9 and 10 these dollar figures being impacted onto the ratepayers? Is it a short period of time, long period of time, 10 years, 5 years?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it would be between now and 2030.
Okay, thank you.
And one thing to just caution about the costs here, we're talking about this study was not meant about the costs. This is talking what you have to do to the transmission network. When you're counting all the costs, I mean, I know in terms of the Excel is saying how wind is their cheapest source of new power they're getting online. When you factor in that, there are additional costs for all the local distribution stuff. There are a whole range of costs, some of which are higher, some of which are lower. The point of this isn't to say is how expensive it is. This is to say what you need. The study was to see, is the transmission system capable of handling this, and if so, what do you have to change for it? So I don't think, I think that, I mean, $373 million, if I'm understanding that's part of that, when I asked what the total would be between upgrades for regular stuff, and you were saying $4 billion or so, this would up the cost of that. And there are other things, as you said, the local stuff will up the cost too, but again, the power generation costs and the fuel cost, of course, all those things are part of the mix too. So I don't think you should see this as they're only talking about part of the cost, because yeah, they're part of the cost, they're part savings, they're coming other ways too. So the point of today's thing isn't, this study was not to be about the cost, this was to be what's feasible, where are we in terms of what needs to be done. But yeah, I think we should keep it in mind. Senator Eaton, Senator Benson, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm pretty much on the same line you were speaking of, because I'm curious about what the cost would be to provide the needed generation of electricity or power if we use non-renewable current conventional practices and didn't go with the renewable. I mean, isn't there a cost to keeping up with that until 2030?
Mr. Chair and Senator Eaton, there is, and this was not a study to try and compare the cost of going to a higher level of renewable generation versus what we would have to do instead in order to maintain a reliable system that was serving all of the customers and all of the load. Clearly, as we look out into the future, those generation plants that rely on fossil fuels, particularly coal, are experiencing and will experience significant cost to maintain their operation and be compliant with federal regulations. So we didn't attempt to estimate those. This isn't a comparative analysis between going to a higher level of renewable penetration and what it would cost if we were to try and move forward with existing plant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to, I mean, because that's where the conversation seemed to be going, and so I would be curious at some point if we could have kind of a scenario of what the actual costs would be either way. I would like to see a comparative.
We will, Sarah Eaton, there will be things like that coming out, and I think the administration is looking at some of them.
Thank you.
I'd like to wrap this up soon because I forgot we have only an hour and a half. But Senator Benson and Senator Hoffman. And
Mr. Chair, it's more of a comment than a question given our short time. The Minnesota Renewable Energy Integration and Transmission would lead me to believe that we'd be talking about integrating. So from the point of the solar facility or the wind facility into our current system. So I would think that we would have reflected the costs from the point of transmission through integration. And so I hope at some point it will become transparent what those costs are. And as usual, the ratepayers are paying the costs, and so we need to be very clear with the public that this is not a complete picture of renewable energy integration and transmission. This is one tiny bite, and we have a long way to go before we fully understand what these costs are going to be.
Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm looking forward to the discussion. You talk about with increased wind and power, there's going to be some discussion on instability within the grids. And also when you look at with that comes the distribution and linked, the distribution of mass is going to be a massive increase in two-way power. I mean, there's going to be a two-way power conversation that's going to have to happen. And what's the challenges, and how do you find out what you're losing? Are you losing 30% of that power in that two-way, construct? Because I'm kicking in and I'm bringing back. It's a good start, and yeah, this is one little small piece, as Senator Benson is saying. So thank you for bringing this up today.
Thank you to all of you for presenting and for taking a very technical study. You got people asking a lot of questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We're going to have Xcel Energy talk about its 2016-2030 Integrated Resource Plan. Welcome to the committee. Mr. Evans, you're going to start?
Very briefly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Rick Evans, Government Affairs of Xcel Energy, and I'm here to field the easy questions. And I've brought with me today Mr. Kurt Hager. He is our Managing Director of Resource Planning, who heads up the group that's responsible for the resource plan that was recently filed here in Minnesota. So in the interest of time, I'm just going to turn it over to Mr. Hager and sit and listen quietly unless there are questions that I can answer. So.
Mr. Hager, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think everybody's getting my handout. There's just a few brief slides. I'm going to go through those. What we're going to discuss this afternoon is our 2015 Upper Midwest Resource Plan. That is Xcel's vision for the resource generation mix and resources that need to be added through 2030. We do file a resource plan every 3 or 4 years. We typically focus on the 15-year period from when we file the plan. So obviously 2015, we are focusing through 2030. The next couple of resource plans will actually get into the 2030 to 2035 time frame, which you'll see later on in the presentation why that becomes important. I think the Upper Midwest Resource Plan is a very delicate balance between a number of items. Certainly reliability is on top of that list, but also cost to customers. Positioning us for the future, renewing our system, and setting us up to be successful with whatever outcome that we see coming forward. If you look at the next page, you look at from a resource capacity need. And again, this is what's important from a reliability standpoint. We have two primary functions that we look at in resource planning. One's the capacity, that's the iron in the ground. That's what you need on the hottest day of the year to make sure that your system's going to be able to handle your full load. And that's what this look is. And you can see in the upper right-hand corner what I've circled in red. Those are the resources that we're looking for between the period of 2015 through 2030. Again, we're looking at a system that's over 10,000 megawatts in size. We're looking at somewhere around 2,500 megawatts of question. You can see a number of other resources that are shown on the graph don't change. And that's kind of the base that's there that we're building upon. And what you can see up there that we have wind and solar and natural gas combustion turbines. We certainly understand, just as the discussion you had this morning, wind doesn't always blow, sun doesn't always shine. Therefore, we need the combustion turbines, the gas resources, to be there to back up those resources. And certainly in this capacity view, you see that the majority of what we're adding from a peak day requirement, a capacity requirement, are combustion turbines. Let's flip over then to the next page, which is the other hemisphere that we work in, and that is energy. That's what we then use the other 364 days of the year. That's what drives cost of our energy. That's what drives emissions. And again, what we tried to position this resource plan is to maintain that delicate balance of a good energy mix. so that we're not reliant on any one energy resource too much. And in this plan, we also set ourselves up not to be too reliant on natural gas energy, because when we get to the next resource plan, the 2030 to 2035, most likely we'll be adding a lot of natural gas to replace older retiring plants. And we'll talk about that in a little bit here. But what we wanted to do in this resource plan was to maintain that balance. So you can see in 2015, on the left-hand side, 55% of our energy comes from carbon-free resources, 30% of the total mix is from nuclear, 15% from wind, 6% and 4% from hydro and bio, 37% from coal, and 8% from natural gas. Again, a relative modest amount of natural gas. We've had a lot of price volatility from natural gas over the last 10 years, and we don't know exactly what the future will bring. Obviously, with fracking, with additional sources, it looks like the price of natural gas is down. But there is still the potential for volatility. So we wanted to make sure that we're not too dependent, again, on any one resource. If you look at our mix in 2030, you can see, again, nuclear stays about the same at 28. Wind goes up to 25. Solar comes up to 8. Coal shrinks a little bit from 37 down to 29. But natural gas stays about the same balance. So, again, I think we're well positioned with this plan going forward so that when we start to meet the challenges beyond 2030, again, we're not beholden to one fuel too much. And again, overall, 63% carbon-free energy. Next slide. The key aspect of one of the things that I keep on talking about is not only what happens in this resource plan, but the next resource plan. You can see the age of our primary base load fleet here. Sherco 1, 2, 3, our King plant, and then our three nuclear units, Monticello and Prairie Island. And you can see in that time frame, around 2030 to 2035, the majority of these plants are going to come either to their end of their license or to their end of their expected plant lives. Now, in this plan, what we tried to do is get as much out of those existing resources as we could. For Sherco 1 and 2, they currently had a book life of 2023. We extended that to 2030. To try to get as much, again, out of those resources we could. And then set up our plan so that when we get to that next plan, again, we're not beholden to too much natural gas, but we're well diversified. But as you can see, we are facing the majority of these plants are coming to their end of their useful life. Next slide. If you look at our overall plan and the large additions that will be coming, most of those additions will be coming in the time frame of 2024 through 2030. We'll get a few additions in the early years, but we're actually situated right now that we actually have a little bit of spare capacity. So we don't need to do a lot of modifications now, so that gives us time to discuss exactly how we implement this plan. We have asked a little bit different process with this plan. We've asked for more a collaborative approach with the stakeholders at the PUC as opposed to a straight litigious type approach, because there are a lot of things that can be moved and modified. One of the things that's very important about our plan, it's very flexible moving forward. To the extent that one of those assumptions don't come true, we can migrate fairly quickly to another path, but really stay on course of still hitting a 40% carbon reduction. And I think also what's important here, you see the overall that we plan to add about 1,800 megawatts of additional wind, about 1,700 megawatts of additional large solar, about 500 megawatts of distributed solar, and about 1,800 megawatts of combustion turbines. Again, a fair mix so that we're not too much in any one camp when it comes to overall energy mix, but a good balance for reliability and also for cost basis. Next slide. And again, one of the key goals here, cost. We wanted to keep the impact on customers down to less than 2% on average over the 15-year period on an annual basis. We also wanted to make sure that we were de-risking our portfolio for carbon. I know there's a lot of debate of whether the cost of carbon, what it is, how you look at it. But the fact is, if we can create a portfolio for our customers that is a reasonable cost and de-risk them from some of the carbon aspects, that's what we wanted to achieve, and I think we've done that. You can see from this projection that by 2030, we'll actually reduce carbon based upon an 2005 level by 40%. It's actually 42%, but we were targeting 40% by 2030 and 30% by 2020. And now if you have some questions.
Yes, Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hager, this increase in solar and wind by 2030, will that be from production in Minnesota, or would that be imported from other states?
Typically, we operate over, obviously, Wisconsin, some in Michigan, Minnesota, the Dakotas. We typically look in that whole area for resources. We have to see how the Clean Power Plan, the proposed EPA rules, play out a little bit, because they are more state-specific. And so we'll have to take that into account a little bit more than we have in the past about where resources are located. But typically, we've gone to the area of resources that are lowest cost, and sometimes within the state, sometimes outside.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hager, so to reach these goals by 2030, would that require, in the states that you mentioned, an increase in the number of wind turbines and solar farms?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes. I mean, we're talking about 1,800 megawatts of additional wind. So certainly we're looking at an investment in additional wind turbines and up to 2,200 megawatts in total between the large solar and the small solar. So certainly more solar installations.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, Mr. Hager, so how many wind turbines, an increase in how many of wind turbines would that be, the number of turbines, and how many acres of solar farms are we talking about for this type of an increase?
Mr. Chair, Senator, good question. The wind turbine itself is dependent upon the developer and what size of turbine he puts in. But again, assuming that it's a 2-megawatt turbine, that would be somewhere around 900 additional turbine locations potentially. As far as the acreage of the solar, I don't have a good figure for you. I'd have to get back to you.
Mr. Chair, the calculation I've been given from our folks who deal in solar that it takes about 7 acres to make a megawatt of solar. That was the most recent information that I had.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to picture what Minnesota is going to look like in 2030, 1,500 miles of transmission lines. That's a road distance from Minneapolis to Tampa, Florida. If we contain all of that within Minnesota and 900 more wind turbines, Minnesota is just going to be a beautiful state come 2030 with all of this added landscape.
We may have some less coal as well. I have a question about the resource capacity slide, the load management. It looks like it's about the same the entire route through there, and I was just curious why that one. Maybe I'm not understanding what you're using as load management, but I'm surprised that that's stable throughout.
You know, our Mr. Chair, our projections for load management are relatively stable as people come on and off the program, and that we, you know, our past history is showing that the energy efficiency has been growing, but our actually load management has not been growing that much. So it is relatively stable.
I just wonder when I see like electric vehicles and other things that people are talking about, I have a feeling just looking at the cost of things that's going to be growing fast. And obviously, I know I think you have to have a rate, a time of day rate or something for vehicle charging tariff at some point this year. I think you have to have that. I'm just looking at things like that it seems to me with your larger customers and so on, not the whatever you call it, the summer air conditioner program, but other things like that. I'm surprised that that's not growing. You just think because historically it hasn't, you're expecting that to be about the same? Or?
Mr. Chair, in our forecast, we tend to put in more knowns than unknowns, and so we don't have a lot in here for like vehicle fleet changeover. And so it doesn't show up in our load, and it doesn't show up in the services, because we don't see a lot of specificity around that in the next 10 years or so. But I think that's why we update these plans every 3 to 4 years, that as we get more information about what's happening, then we take that into account. And again, to the extent that in that fleet management process and in battery storage, to the extent that that would allow for more movement of peak and more demand response, then we would incorporate that as we get more hard facts around that. But right now, because it's far enough out in kind of the future, we can add that. That's why I was saying that we could migrate our plans as we get more specificity about some of those things.
And I understand that your plans are constantly changing, but when you look at the, and I don't know how far out you plan. I assume it's not 15 years. I assume it's 40, 50, 60 right. years in some of these things. Given that from 2030 to 2035, going to be a lot of change, your next IRP is going to have, the very end of it's going to be a lot of stuff happening. You're planning on that now. Is it sort of in this direction? What do you talk about? I mean, how does that fit in? How does that next 5 years turn in, or the next 3 years, next time you put out a plan?
So again, the next planning cycle, about, Mr. Chair, approximately 3 to 4 years, and so then we would extend it to look at the 2030 to 2033 or 34 time frame. So that's when more of those decisions would come in. Obviously, we update all of our assumptions going into that process. So to the extent that we see, you know, again, more along the lines of battery development, just like we did solar. I mean, if you look back 3 years ago, distributed generation, we're proposing potentially 500 megawatts of that. 3 years ago, I think it was zero. And so that's the kind of the magnitude of change that can take place. With the flexibility of gas resources and other resources, we have the ability to modify the plan as we go forward. And therefore, we're not locked into specific resource decisions here. I think what we're showing is we have a path that we can migrate from to hit our targets.
And obviously, these being such fast-changing times, 3 years from now will be very significantly different, 6 years from now will be very significantly different, so on.
Mr. Chairman, yes. I mean, that is exactly the case.
I don't remember who is next. Senator Benson?
Good. Mr. Chair, and if I could ask, and I've forgotten your name, Mr. Hager, I'm looking at your generation addition slide, your large solar by 2025, 1,600 megawatts?
Yes.
At 7 acres per megawatt? Is that what I heard? How many acres is that? And where are you going to get it?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think based upon the calculation, it would be roughly around 11,000 acres. And again, to the extent where we would get it, depending upon where the development happened, again, it could come from the Dakotas, it could come from Minnesota, it could come from a number of areas, you know, within the service territory.
Mr. Benson.
And Mr. Chair, land's not cheap. Farmland, you know, $5,000 an acre hasn't been historically out of line. That's a lot of money to invest. And the whole purpose of Minnesota's renewable energy standards and our SIP programs was to be energy independent. So somehow we're opposed to importing coal from North Dakota or natural gas from the Bakken, but now we can put up a solar array in South Dakota and import the electricity from there. So I'm just seeing a little bit of inconsistency in policy as we go forward. And so, you know, commendable that you're working on large solar arrays. Land's not free, and I'm not seeing people understanding how much it costs to build solar facilities being presented at the table.
Oh, so coal's not free either in terms of health or environment or other things, too. But, I mean, everything's trade-offs.
Mr. Chair, I wonder if I could just, you know, make a comment on that, because it's important that the committee understand the resource planning process, like any projection, whether you're projecting the state budget forecast or projecting you know, climate change or anything else is based on a set of assumptions that are built in based on our best understanding of what we see in the future now. One of the things we see in the future, regardless of Minnesota state policy, is a federal policy that is driving the cost of carbon emission up. And so we need to assume that when we're trying to find the best financial result for our customers. And that's built into these assumptions. Of course, if the price of land became, you know, made it more difficult to build solar, if the price of solar were to go up instead of down, if the cost of carbon were to go down instead of up or something like that, all of those things would then be built into the assumptions of the next resource plan. So all of those things that you're talking about are assumed in the projections, but the understanding, of course, is they're only our best assumptions about what the future will hold, which is why we do the updates as frequently as we do.
Senator Rosen, Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Evans and Mr. Hager, I appreciate this. I have a couple questions here. Are these Xcel wind farms, or will you be buying the energy off of other farms that have been in production?
Chairman, Senator, that decision has not been made yet. You know, typically we've gone for a mix of independent ownership and also utility-constructed facilities. I expect that would continue.
Mr. Chair, and thank you. Mr. Evans, you said the assumptions. Does that assumption, this assumption, include the federal tax production credit ongoing? Because that is truly the only way someone is going to be able to afford and will produce another wind farm down in my area. They have to have that.
Mr. Chair.
They have to have that incentive.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator, we actually include a price that assumes that the production tax credit goes away. So when we do our production modeling, our base runs include wind at $70 to $80 a megawatt hour. So that assumes that the production tax credit is no longer in existence. We did do a sensitivity to show what the impact is if they were able to get wind with production tax credits and the benefits of the production tax credits. But our base plan assumes that the production tax credit for wind and the ITC for solar expire.
Interesting. And given the fact that what happens in Congress is hard to predict, you run numbers on everything, but the assumption is that they go away when they're scheduled to.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
How many different runs do you do on everything? You have thousands of scenarios, I assume?
Yes.
Senator Eaton, then Senator Osborne.
Thank you. I was wondering if you could explain to me what happens to hydro that it decreases from 2015 to 2030.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we have a contract with Manitoba Hydro that expires in 2025. Our policy is that we do not put in renewals of contracts with third-party providers unless we have an arrangement with that provider. We do not have an arrangement with Manitoba past 2025. That doesn't necessarily mean that we won't get an arrangement with Manitoba Hydro, mm-hmm. But we currently do not show extensions unless we have them under contract.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
That's helpful to understand. I wonder.
Mr. Chair, and just for Senator Eaton's benefit, if you look at this chart here, you see the yellow bar in the middle of it disappearing at about 2025 or 2026, and that's what that represents.
Mr. Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was one of my questions, was what just happened there. But that makes sense. I certainly hope that we will be able to integrate and maintain that resource to keep that as part of our portfolio. The other question I had for you is, you know, we've been talking about how many windmills and how much solar we're going to need to get to this point. I'm sure that, you know, inside of the 694, 494 loop, there would be plenty of places and plenty of senators that would be more than happy to have their fair share in their districts. That being said, the one big elephant in the room is the nuclear section, that even if we're just moving from 15% to 25%, and we're already putting this much more wind and solar on the grid, how is it at all possible we cannot have nuclear as part of our portfolio going forward to past 2032 which I think is the license expiration for the three nuclear reactors.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator, currently Monticello is licensed through, I believe, September of 29, 30, and then the Prairie Island units are in 2033 and 2034. But certainly that is a key piece of the puzzle that we're already, again, trying to position ourselves here so that if we work on an answer in 3 to 4 years when we have to start talking about either relicensing those facilities or retiring.
Thank you.
And, yeah, because you're going to have a lot of cliffs in the early 30s in terms of things. How far out do you plan internally? I mean, is it 40 years, 50 years? Obviously, when you put in a plant that's going to be, you expect to last, nuclear plants were assumed, was it 30-year initial license or 40 years?
Mr. Chairman, we do plan 40 years out, and so we typically look at that. And the nuclear, I believe the original license was 40 years, and the extension was 20.
And if you look back at your plans, 20 years, when did you first start doing IRPs?
When did I start?
When did
Excel
start being required?
I've been here almost 34 years. No. In Minnesota, I don't know the history prior to our merger. I might be able to ask. I mean, I know in at the merger time, we were developing the IRPs and doing that process. I don't know. Many of the utilities around the United States picked up integrated resource planning again in the late 90s. When the resource need became more evident again, a number of utilities were in a position that they had excess resources through the 80s, and then the resource planning efforts came back in the middle of the 90s. So I'm guessing that that's probably when Minnesota.
I'd be curious what the early ones looked like compared to now. But when you look back in time, I mean, it's always interesting to see how things play out. Are there further questions? Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one further question. From the beginning of replacing one of the three nuclear reactors, how long does that take? I've always wondered how long from the planning phase, from the first meeting that you have, until electricity is actually coming out of a new nuclear reactor, how long, as an estimate, do you think that's going to take?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, for a new nuclear reactor as opposed to a relicense, we have to start about 10 to 11 years before the relicensing period for an existing reactor. For a new reactor, you're probably talking in the 15 to 18-year time frame.
And one more question back to the large solar. By the way, these numbers in this generation additions, those are cumulative in effect. So you're adding the... like the wind bars between the two and solar and so on. When you said that these were assuming that the federal incentives go away, do you have projections on what price will be by that time? I mean, because I know you gauge everything conservatively, not assuming there's going to be it's not going to be a tax incentive or anything else unless it's in law. How do you assume what prices are going to be? Because obviously you're assuming some fall there.
Mr. Chairman, just to make sure we're on the same page, just on this graph, these are the additions in those years, so they're not cumulative at the end. They're actually in
those
years.
We have to add them together ourselves.
Correct. Okay. You have to add them together. As far as the pricing, what we do is we take the construction cost associated with a wind farm or a solar array, and we escalate that over time. We then back out the tax credit from what we see in today's pricing to come up with that future pricing. Just to give people an idea of a range, again, I said wind on a levelized cost basis is about $70 to $80, depending upon when it would start out there. And solar is in the $95 to $100 range of costs that we've assumed in this plan. Again, much higher than what we saw with the production investment tax credits.
Thank you. Any other questions? If not, I appreciate Excel coming in and making your presentation on this. Thank you very much. And with that, there's no further business.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Osmond.
Just a question for our members. Do we have an idea on the upcoming couple of weeks here where we're going to be doing or when we're going to be doing hearings, if we're going to have any in the next couple of session days?
We know what these, when are they? Two meetings next week, I think.
Two next week, not one Thursday, though.
Not this Thursday. I think the Legislative Energy Commission is having a brief presentation on the propane study, I think.
Yep.
I think in this room, so members of the LEC and anybody else who wants to come are welcome for that as well.
Okay,
that
thank you.
That should be fairly brief. With that, this meeting is adjourned.
Did you start it exactly on time?
I love that.
Hey, Bill, I started buying property.
Is what it says.
12 to 1:30.
Good job. You get it.